an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. My name is Jack Tissot. And it's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be a participant and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I especially enjoy this room, and I've been here a number of times. We had a nice time coming down. My wife came with me, and we stopped in Laguna and walked around a little while and had a leisurely time down here, and then had dinner downstairs. And to the best of my recollection, we didn't fight at all. That's not what it used to be like, let me tell you that. But, sir, you know, even in the littlest ways, I noticed the effect of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. It's been an extraordinary change for me. And I didn't really think I was going to be able to participate in it. It didn't seem like it would be right for me. It wasn't so much that I had no problems. I had sufficient problems to deal with. By the time I found Alcoholics Anonymous, or it found me, I've never been sure which, I had been arrested 10 times. The first time was for manslaughter when I was 17, and I had totaled 12 cars. My liver was not doing very well. My wife was divorcing me. My four children, the youngest was 7, the oldest was 20, were not speaking to me. I had not worked in 3 years. I used to describe myself as a functioning alcoholic. Well, that's somebody that's married to somebody that does work. See, that's how that is. I had no friends left anywhere. And other than that, my life was going pretty well. See? And so it was not that I had no problems. I had plenty of problems. I had just gotten out of jail the night before I got 12-step. That is the only arrest that I have ever contested. The others were legitimate. I mean, the first one when I was 17, I just finished a six-pack, and I wasn't a very good driver nor an experienced driver, and I caused an accident in which a man died. And the last one, however, in between there, I was arrested for inciting a riot and for contributing to the delinquency of a minor and a variety of charges. The very last one, I never felt that they had probable cause. I mean, all that happened is my extreme caution while driving, and I mean, after totaling 12 cars, you should be cautious, you know. My extreme caution while driving drew the attention of the heat to me. I sat through 3 green lights waiting for the right one. Well, I just couldn't get the right shade of green, you know what I mean? And they pulled me over and discovered, to nobody's surprise, that I was drunk, you know. I measured 2.7 that night, thank you. And so that's the way it was. And the next morning, they gave me a kick out at 5:30, and I called my wife, and she had come down to the deputy sheriff's station on San Vicente in L.A. to, is somebody familiar with it? Yes, it's decent accommodations, you know. She had come down to bail me out because she hadn't been to Al-Anon yet and she didn't know any better, and someone had notified her that I needed to be bailed out, and she'd come down there and attempted to do it, but they wouldn't bail me. Now, at 5:30 in the morning, they gave me a kick out. So, I mean, they didn't plan to charge me, but they just wanted to make it as inconvenient for me as possible, you know. And the reason for that was that I had managed to offend the arresting officers, and then when they were booking me, I made fun of the jailer's name. And then I did my citizen act, you know. I said, you have a right to a phone call. I said, yeah, you do. I said, okay, loan me a dime, you know. And I didn't think that was too funny. And then it was 3 o'clock in the morning in Los Angeles, and I called New York City, and they didn't think that was funny at all, you know. And so when Gene showed up, they lost me in a building which is not as big as this one, you know. I mean, they knew where I was. I was curled up in the drunk tank around the drain there. And anyway, they didn't do that. They sent her home, and then they gave me a kick out. and called her, and we had one of our typical conversations. I said, "Where the hell were you when I needed you?" And she said, "I was there. I'll stay where you are. I'll come right back and get you." And I said, "Don't bother. I'll walk." And I hung up on her. I don't know why I called her. I guess just to make her feel bad, you know. So I walked home and stumbled and staggered and stopped on the way to get well. And when I got home, she was leaving for work. And just prior to that, 2 days earlier, my four children had gotten together in my front room. The oldest was living in Phoenix, and she flew back especially to be in my front room to tell me that they didn't love me, want me, or need me. And they told me to get the hell out of their lives. And they told me to leave their mother alone, that I was killing her. And they had a suitcase all packed for me. And I marched out of that house feeling lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid, exactly the way I felt all my life. I always felt like that. And I did the only thing I ever knew how to do about it. I got drunk. And I stepped in the car that night, and next morning I called Jean and begged her like a child to take me back. And she didn't know any better, so she did. And the next day, I was drunk again, and that was the green light incident, and then they gave me a kick out. So I met her at the door. She was leaving for work, and she said, "The kids were right. I never should have let you back, and I never will again." Now, I had developed a number of skills that are necessary for survival for an alcoholic of my type, and one of them is the ability to tell when they mean it, you know. And I got that. She meant it. This time she meant it. Now, I had been out of that house dozens of times. We've never been able to count them all up. I mean, I had snuck out, stormed out, escaped, you know, been thrown out, kicked out. This time, I knew she meant it, that it really was over, and she left. And I felt lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid. I went out to the kitchen, and I reached back under the sink where I had a bottle of white wine hidden, and I got my stash out. I had a tiny little bit of grass left, and I rolled the skinniest little J you ever saw, and I licked the baggie, you know. Waste not, want not. My mother taught me that. And I smoked a joint and drank the wine and passed out on the bed. Nothing new, no changes, you know. And Jean went to work, and on the way to work, it occurred to her for the first time in the 17 years that we've been together, there was a new idea. And she got to her office, and she looked up in the phone book, alcoholism. And she called them and told them about us. And whoever spoke to her understood what was going on and gave her some instructions. And so Jean came back home at lunchtime and found me lying there on the bed, not bothering anybody, you know. And she started to get me conscious. And that wasn't always very easy in those days. And by the time she did, she was crying. Now, I have seen her cry many times in pain, fear, rage, humiliation, hatred. I'm sure she hated me the night in front of the four children when she wanted to put a knife in my belly. And I didn't object. I mean, I raised my hands. I said, "Go ahead, do it. You would be doing us both a favor." But she couldn't. She just stood there and cried. And when I awakened that noontime, I didn't recognize the nature of her tears. It's because I had never seen them before. I was a couple months sober before it dawned on me that those were tears of compassion. That as she got me conscious, it had dawned on her that I was dying of a disease that I never chose to have. And so she finally got me awake. She blurted out what they told her to say. She said, "Jack, you're sick." I knew that. "You've been through the 3 days I've been through, you'd be sick too. I've been doing weed, speed, and booze for 3 days. The only sleep I got at all was in the drunk tank there for a little nap." And, you know, and so she said, "Let me get you help." And I said, "Okay." I didn't ask her what kind. Who cares? I needed help to sit up, you know. So she left the room. She went out to make this phone call. And, you know, in the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of research done on us. Ever since the insurance industry discovered alcoholism, they've done a lot of research, and they've discovered some interesting things, you know. There are a lot of us in this room who have made the little joke at the bar and say, the waitress goes by and you say, nurse, you know, would you please bring me my medication? Well, turns out that's true. I mean, that is exactly what we're doing. One of the things that an alcoholic of my type, I am lacking sufficient neurotransmitters in comparison to normal people. I don't manufacture enough endorphin on my own. And guess what booze helps me to manufacture? So when I do booze, I'm medicating, you know? And that was a little research that the insurance industry discovered in their study of us. Most of the things they've learned are kind of that sort of physiological knowledge which verifies stuff we already knew, you know, experiences of ours. Like, for example, in the book it says there, we are like men and women who have lost their legs. We will never grow new ones. And the point of that is that our experience and our friends' experience of having been a long time, in some cases, away from a drink, and then take a drink and have it just be as bad or worse than it ever was. And so we say we're like men and women who have lost their legs. And the research has shown that the reason for that, and alcoholics of my type, when I drink, ever since I started, every time I drank, I manufactured a little chemical called tetrahydroisoquinoline, and I store it in my brain. And it's never excreted, it's just stored. And I kept storing this THIQ. And if I were to drink again, the alcohol would mix with that THIQ and cause the kinds of things that it was when I stopped. Things like, you know, I'll have a few glasses of beer with you and then suddenly say, let's go to Tijuana, you know, or attend a party and have a little cocktail and then find myself throwing your coffee table through the front window, you know, or goosing the hostess. I never know what I'm going to do, you know. And so I'm like a man who's lost his leg. I never will grow a new one. And so the research goes along with that. But there still is an attitude among many of the professionals that deal with us, a kind of a secret feeling that our problem is that we are lacking in willpower. Now, you and I know that's ridiculous. I mean, but it, people do have. The reason they're confused is they have never fully understood our goals. I mean, I'd like to see them get to work on time, feeling the way we do some days, you know. I mean, you walk in and they say, my God, you're green. They say, oh, that's all right, I'll be okay. Just let me get till noon and I'll be fine, you know. So it isn't lack of willpower. And I had exhibited some willpower that very morning. I had reserved a half a glass out of that bottle for when I wake up. That's not easy to do. And I failed many times. I'd wake up and the damn bottle would be empty. I used to say, Jack, you have no foresight. I had managed to save a half a glass. Jean left the room. She didn't say anything about not drinking. She was going to go get help. And I didn't drink it. I don't know why. I didn't drink it. Instead, I shuffled after her to the phone. I wasn't very quick in those days. And she'd completed the connection, and she said, he wants to talk to you. Well, she was a little surprised, and I was amazed. I mean, nobody wanted to talk to me. If I picked up the phone, which I rarely did, but if I picked up the phone and happened to be a bill collector, they'd say, when is your wife coming home? You know, I mean, they didn't want to talk to me. Nobody did. And this guy said he wanted to talk to me. And I grabbed the phone, and he said, hi, my name is Bud. I'm an alcoholic. Can I help you? And I heard myself say, maybe you could. Where did that come from? I don't want your help. I don't need it, and I don't want it. Don't help me, okay? And this guy said, can I help you? And I said, maybe you could. And then other strange things. He said, all right, why don't you come up and see me? I said, where are you? And he said, Oxnard. I said, my God, that's 77 miles away from my house. And he said, okay, it'll take you a little while. I'll wait. I said, all right, I'll go. I'll come. And he said, oh, and by the way, don't drink anything between now and then. And, hey, don't tell me what to do. You know what I'm saying? I don't follow rules, okay? I never did. I don't like rules. I used to run red lights for drill. You know what I'm saying? And this guy is telling me, don't drink. And I heard myself say, okay, I won't. Strange stuff. And I didn't. I knew that if I were away from a drink for as long as 2 hours, that I'd liable to have some shakes and maybe worse. I mean, I sometimes got into what I think is called chronic jerk. I mean, just sudden involuntary movements, you know. People wave back at you, you know. So I got Gene to do the driving, and I just shook, you know. And we got up there, and this guy sat us down, and he had a year and a half of sobriety at the time. He told us what it used to be like, what happened, and what it was like then for him. And I want to tell you, you know, when I was 4 years old, I discovered that I lived in an unpredictable world of violence. My father was an alcoholic, and I never knew when he was going to come home late. If he got home at 5:20, it meant he left work right on time and was home. And if it was later than that, it was trouble. And if it got to be 6 or 7, it was big trouble. If it got to be that late, then what we all started to hope for is it would be very late. Because maybe if it got as late as 11 or 12 o'clock, he'd be so drunk he wouldn't cause trouble. You know, but most of the time he'd come stumbling in, obsessive and raging, and maybe put his fist through a window or choke my mother or hurt one of the kids, and so that was the world I lived in. Starting, I recognized it when I was 4, and when I was 9 years old, Hitler marched into Poland, and I became a spy. I started to spy on the human race. I tried to figure out what the hell you were doing. I eavesdropped on conversations my whole life, just trying to figure out what you talk about when I'm not around, you know? And I don't think it's about me. I just don't know how you do it. I don't know how you live. And I got good, as a spy must, of wearing disguises. I got a lot of disguises that I could pass among you and appear to be just like you. And I wasn't like you at all, and I knew it. One of the disguises that I put on was when I was 14 years old. I was just inadequate. I couldn't contain. I was the oldest of the children, and I couldn't manage my father, and I felt hopeless and inadequate, and I just wanted to escape, and I was full-blown alcoholic who hadn't really started drinking yet, but I had a lot of the character traits, like, for example, deviousness, and so I decided to run away from home without anybody knowing I was doing it. And if you're Irish Catholic in South Bend, Indiana, there is one disguise you can put on, and I did that. I went to the seminary and studied to be a priest at Notre Dame. And I was there for 2.5 years, 20 hours of silence a day from the ages of 14 through 16, trying not to think about girls. Finally, I said, what an order, I can't go through with it. And I came back, and I got drunk the next night. I got drunk the very next night. And 6 months later, I had my first arrest, you know. And that first night, if anybody had any objectivity, it would be clear that this is an alcoholic, but I who knew? But I experienced a number of my symptoms that very first night. I mean, I was shy, spiritual, quiet. You may not be able to tell by looking at me now, but I was small. And I had a few beers with these guys, and I turned into a crazy person. I shattered the windshield of this one guy's car with the heel of my shoe. Took off my shoe and battered his windshield in. I got maniacal. I was just trying to kill somebody. I mean, it took 3 guys to subdue old 5, 6, and 120. And they did manage it, and they got me in the back of the car and put me on the floor, and 2 guys sat in the back seat and held me to the floor, and the 3rd guy drove me home. And on the way home, I experienced another personality change. I just became warm and wonderful. And I cried. And I threw up on his floor. And they got me to my house, and they helped me out of the car, and they helped me up to the front door, and leaned me against the front door of my house like a thing, and pushed the doorbell and ran, because they didn't want to deal with my father. And my father opened the door, and here was his oldest son, ex-seminarian by one day, 16 years old, drunk. And my father did the only thing he knew how to do. He punched me out. And that was my first night of serious drinking. And I loved it. I loved it. I never skipped a drink for the next 24 years, to the best of my ability. So I was a spy, and I always was. I had that ambivalent thing that alcoholics do. I wanted to know what was wrong with me, but not really. You know, I mean, it's a strange thing. I was in therapy for 3 years in New York with a pretty expensive psychiatrist, and I was never late. And I never missed an appointment, and I never told him the truth. You know? I didn't really want to know. And so here, Bud was telling me about his life, and suddenly it occurred to me that this guy was another spy. I mean, he knew what it felt like to be me at 3 a.m. I thought nobody knew that. I thought nobody knew the thoughts that went through my head. And he knew. He was talking about himself. And so that impressed me. I wasn't all impressed with his length of sobriety or any of that, because I knew that was out of the question for me. But I did see that this truly was a kindred soul. And so I did pay a little attention to some of the things he said. And he got me to do some stuff. I mean, he got me to make a promise. I hadn't made a promise in years, because I don't keep them. So I just stopped giving them. And he made me promise that I would read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, before I took another drink. And I said I would. He also convinced me to stay there that night in the detox center. Well, he had a little help from Jean that night. I mean, he wanted me to do it, but she had control of the keys to our only car, and she had all the money. So I knew if I didn't agree to stay there, I was going to have to walk back home from Oxnard, you know, and I figured, what the hell, I'll stay there. And the next day, they moved me out to a 12-step house, and at 11 o'clock in the morning, I was standing underneath a palm tree in Oxnard, and I had just successfully completed the AA program. No, yeah, well, he explained how it worked. He said you do it one day at a time, and I had just done that. I had been an entire day, 24-hour period, without having any booze or dope. And I didn't like it. And I decided to resign from your organization. And I mean, and she was not going to come back and get me, I knew that. And she neglected to leave me any money. So that meant I was going to have to walk or hitchhike. And when I finally got there, I was going to have to boost a bottle or panhandle. I mean, I could see it was going to be a long day, you know what I mean? And I wanted to discharge my obligation, so I went back into that place and I found a big book. And I said, okay, I'm going to do what I told this guy. I said I would read before I took the drink. And so I started to do that. And I need to tell you that by then, of course, most of my symptoms were rampant. And one of my symptoms is that I had become, over the years, I had become an intellectual. I now define an intellectual as someone who has been educated beyond his capacity. But in those days, it was a very serious matter for me. It was a desperate effort on my part to gain some control. If I could understand the nature of the human psyche or the universe, maybe I could gain some control. And I'd been out of control since I was 16 years old. And it was also an effort on my part to impress you. I desperately needed to impress you because I had been filled with self-loathing and a deep sense of inadequacy since I was 4 years old. The only relief I ever got was when I impressed you. And so I used the intellectuality in an effort to impress you. And with all that going on, I picked up the book and I opened it and I immediately saw that it did not meet my literary standards. It was a book that plain-spoken and I thought simple-minded could hardly be of any use to somebody of my complexity. I mean, I found things in there to ridicule. There's a line, you can look it up. It suggests that I should substitute for my drinking. I gave you a little hint of my drinking. I should substitute for my drinking the fellowship. That's not going to work, folks. I mean, let's start with the fact that I don't like people, okay? I mean, hanging out with you is hardly going to keep me sober. I mean, I didn't even like the word fellowship. Sounded to me like a Baptist softball team. I don't want to be part of your fellowship. Thanks a lot. And I could see through that book's feeble efforts to hide its real intent behind euphemisms like higher power. That book was trying to cram God down my throat. And I did not believe in God. And I didn't think you should either. One of my little entertainments in those days was to go to bars named Molly Malone's or Barney's Beanery and find some big Irish Catholic and get him into a discussion. I'd say, do you believe in God? He'd say, oh yeah. I'd say, a loving, just, and merciful God, right? He'd say, right. I'd say, yeah. What about malformed children and disease and war and poverty and bigotry and death? Where's your loving God? Usually about then, they would beat me up to show me there was a power greater than myself. And that was the attitude with which I read the book. And in spite of my attitude, when I got to page 21 of that book, for the first time ever, I discovered what was the matter with me. And I had been willing to accept the diagnosis of all kinds. I mean, I had been willing to be called paranoid schizophrenic or manic depressive, psychopath, sociopath, artist, any of those diagnoses. And on page 21 of the book, it described what it called a real alcoholic. It says they're seldom mildly intoxicated, usually more or less insanely drunk. It says they do absurd, tragic, incredible things. It says they're disgustingly, even dangerously antisocial. It talks about the Jekyll and Hyde personality and our lousy timing. All in one paragraph. By the time I completed that paragraph, it was clear. I'm an alcoholic. I actually am. That's what's the matter with me. And I read the book then with a little more attention. When I got to page 24, it said that I will drink again. I mean, it's very clear. It says, the real alcoholic has lost the power to choose whether they will drink or not. They have no mental defense against the first drink. Oh, I was hallucinating, but I was never stupid. I can figure that out. That means I'm going to drink. And when I do, I'm going to relive page 21 over and over again. God, it was a hopeless moment for me. What the hell am I going to do? I can't do what you suggest. You know, all this stuff was in a chapter called There Is a Solution. But see, the solution didn't apply to me. I can't work those steps. I thought, what the hell can I do? I said, okay, one thing I could do, I'll go to their meetings. I'm not going to like it, but I'll go. And so I did. The very next night, on a Wednesday night, I went to my first meeting. And I loved the meetings from the beginning. I just loved the meetings. I liked the speaker meetings, especially. I liked to hear the adventure stories, you know. This one guy got up and said, I stole a battleship. Now, you got to like a guy like that. I mean, oh. I've been thinking lately, how would you like to have an oil spill on your amends list? Huh? Let's see, there's Mom and Dad and Alaska. Oh, God. So I like the meetings. I love the meetings, you know. And I listened for hints about how do you stay sober? How do you do that? And one of the hints that I got was get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. And right after I got him, I realized that he didn't have enough education to deal with somebody of my complexity. It's a little embarrassing, but I have to admit to you that I gave Fred Ellis a quiz to see if he was qualified to deal with me. I mean, I didn't actually tell him it was a test, but I asked him a kind of a complicated question about the psychological interrelatedness of the steps. Let's see how he does with that. And Fred looked at me with these huge, gentle eyes. And he said, Jack, the steps are numbered for the intellectuals. If you will do them in order, they will work. I thought that was a pretty good answer, so I didn't fire him, you know. And in fact, in just a couple of days, I got enough courage and trust in Fred to tell him the truth. And I said, the truth is I can't work the steps. The truth is I can't come to believe that there is a power that will restore me. And Fred answered me, he always did. The only thing is, his answers never seemed to match my questions, you know. It was just, but he did answer. I give you an example of that kind of confusion that he always caused in me. When I was about 3 months sober, I had a fight with Gene. And I called him. And in great detail, I enumerated all of the unforgivable things that she had said to me in that fight. All of the rotten names she called me. I made it very clear to him what a bitch I was married to, you know? And I was only 3 months sober. I knew what he was going to say. I knew he would say, gee, you know, you're only sober a little while. Maybe you should get out of that house for a while. And instead, what he said is, all right, here's what you do. You go to her and you say, I'm a sick son of a bitch, but I'm trying. I said, Fred, I don't think you heard what I told you. And he said, no, I got it. I mean, I did. I told him again just to be sure. And he said, no. You do what I said. And I didn't want to drink, and I was trying to follow his guidance. So I did. I went out the kitchen. I found her there at the kitchen with her back to me, slamming pots. She used to call that washing the dishes. And I stood there behind her, and I tried to say what Fred had told me to say, and my throat closed. I wanted to say it, I just couldn't do it. And finally I gave up. I went into the dining room and I found a slip of paper and I wrote it out on a slip of paper, you know, and slipped it into her Al-Anon book. I mean, it was the best I could do. And give you an idea of the kind of program Jean was working at the time, it took her 3 weeks to find it. Well, I must have known, I felt better, I did. And on this occasion I was talking to Fred and said, I can't work the second step. And he said, one of his answers, you know, he said, well, God comes to me through other people. Go to the meetings and search for God. Oh, terrific, Fred. Yeah, that's what I'll do. Good. I hung up. What the hell? Of course God comes to him through other people. How else would Fred get it? The man hardly reads. If God were to come to me, it would have to be, I think, in a white light on a mountaintop, you know. But I didn't want to drink, and I was following his directions, so I did what he said. I went to the meetings, and I searched for God. I didn't find him, but I looked. And I know this is a misperception, but it did seem to me like every one of the speakers that I heard during that search for God period, or each had about a third grade education. They all got sober in Tyler, Texas, and they were dispensing folk wisdom. This one guy got up, I swear to you, and he said, if you don't believe in a power which is greater than yourself, then jump up and stay there. What the hell is that? I didn't think that was funny. I'm sitting out there trying to find God, and this guy is telling me that gravity will restore me to sanity. I don't see how that's going to work. About the only thing I could really hold on to is something else that Fred had said, and that is, no matter what. He said, no matter what, don't use, don't drink. And I said, okay, and I made a list of no matter what. If those four children never speak to me again, I will not use or drink. No matter what, no matter what. If I never am able to work again, I will not use or drink. No matter what. If my mind is never restored to me, I will not use, I will not drink. And it took me 90 days to memorize the Serenity Prayer. I just couldn't hold it in my hand. And my hallucinations did not disappear the day I got sober. I remember sitting next to Fred on a real hot August night, and a huge black bug came flying right at me and then darted between my sponsor and me, and we ended up looking at each other. I didn't say anything. The first thing it was said, Fred said. He looked at me and he said, it was really there, Jack. I didn't ask him. You know, I'd be damned if I'd asked him, but I was pleased to hear it. So I said, no matter what, no matter what, If my wife of 17 years goes through with her plan to divorce me, I will not use, I will not drink. If she stays, I will not use, I will not drink. No matter what. And when I was 30 days clean and sober, I had a spiritual experience. It consisted of being 30 days clean and sober. So I really can't do that, and I knew it. I can't do that. I never did. I just can't. The closest I ever came one time in New York, Gene, through cajolery and threats and everything, begging, managed to get me to stop drinking for 3 weeks. And it took an enormous quantity of cocaine and grass to get me through those 3 weeks. And I never tried it again, you know, that's it. And so here I was, 30 days clean and sober. And I knew it was not possible. And that is a spiritual experience, precisely as it is described in that most profound of books, Alcoholics Anonymous, in a rather obscure section of our book called Appendix 2, where it says, we tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which we presently came to identify with our own conception of a power greater than ourselves. Some of our religious-minded members call that God conscious. And I had tapped an unsuspected inner resource that made it possible for me to stay sober an incredible length of time, 30 days in a row. Couldn't get over it. And I went to Fred. I said, you know, I think I'm working the second step. He wasn't all that impressed. He said, fine, go ahead and work the third step. And I did, and I have been doing that ever since, working the steps, practicing the principles to the best of my ability. And that's been for 23 days and 3 months and 19 years. And who could expect that, you know? I had no idea that that was going to happen. And there are new people here, those who raised their hands or stood up and those who didn't. And let me just say that AA isn't really about not drinking. It isn't about teaching you how to not drink. It isn't about that. And if you're new and if you try to get some advice, you've already found that out. I mean, if you go to an old-timer and ask us, how do I stop drinking, we say brilliant things like, don't pick up the first drink. Oh, good, I hadn't thought of that. AA isn't about not drinking. AA is about living sober. That's the difference. We don't work the steps in order to stop drinking. We stop drinking, and then it is necessary to work the steps. I mean, so Fred began to walk me through and to teach me about living, and I didn't know very much about it. One of the things he said is just, it is required if you want to stay sober, you have to be rigorously honest. And I said, okay, well, I'll do that. He said, you don't even know what it means. I said, wait a minute. Now, God damn it. I went to Notre Dame. I graduated. I went to graduate school in Columbia at Fordham. I've been trained in psychology by the government when I was in the Army. And you barely got out of high school. And he said, this is what honesty means. When your mind, your mouth, and your behavior coincide. I said, oh, I didn't know that. I never did know that. And he said, you need to be rigorously honest. And in your case, you're married, that means you have to be faithful. And I said, I didn't know that. No, I can't do that. I mean, I had been unfaithful in that relationship for the entire 17 years, to the best of my ability, you understand? And he said, no, it doesn't work like that. You have to be faithful in that marriage. And it's not being faithful to the woman. It's being faithful to the promise you made. And I said, but Fred, I mean, I don't even know if I love her. And he said, oh, no, you don't love her. I said, what are you talking about? He said, no, you don't know how to love. We're going to teach you that here. And in your case, we will start with politeness. If she cooks, say thank you. Can you handle that? You know, I said, well, I'll try, you know. And I started to try. And I stayed faithful. And one of the reasons I bring this up is amazing things have happened, including that it has worked. when I'm willing to do what AA asks me to do in order to stay sober, it's worked, I'm still here, but also there have been gifts over and above that I never expected, you know. And when I was about 3 years sober, I called Fred to complain. I said, you know, I've been doing what you tell me, and it's working, I'm still here, but she still does not trust me. And we're together now 20 years. And he said, well, let's figure out how long did it take you to teach her not to trust you. We figured it was 17 years. So he said, fine. When you get 17 years clean and sober and faithful, then the score will be even. I said, thanks a lot, you know, oh, man. And I kept on going. And as I did, it dawned on me somewhere along the line that in those first 17 years, I had essentially this one experience with a variety of women. And in the last over 19 years, I've had a variety of experiences with one woman, and I found out that's better. I just found out it's better. It is more interesting, more adventurous. It's better. It's just better. Fred died, it'll be 4 years ago in March, so he wasn't here to see it. But when I was 17 years clean and sober and faithful, my wife gave me a little medallion that I wear around my neck. It says, 17, even. And we're still together. It's 36 years, you know, and it's an amazing thing how it works, you know. And Fred kept trying to teach me how to live. And he told me that I had to listen to my, I had to learn what I was thinking when I wasn't thinking. I said, what is that? He said, there is an automatic, there's a radio station in your head that is always on 24 hours. It broadcasts misinformation, lies, and propaganda, and you don't even know it's there. And you are responding to it without even knowing it. And so he taught me to start to listen to the sounds in my head. And it was an incredible experience. I call that radio station KVOE. That's the voice of the ego. And I have a list of some of the things it says. We could add to this list, you and I, ad infinitum, but some of the things that I've heard are, I can't remember names, you can't trust anyone, it's going to be another one of those days, I just can't handle it, it's just no use, I just know it won't work, nothing ever goes right for me, that's just my luck, I'm so clumsy, I don't have the talent, I'm just not creative, everything I eat goes right to my waist, I just can't seem to get organized, today just isn't my day, I can never afford the things I want, I already know I won't like it, I never have enough time, no matter what I do, I can't seem to lose weight, I'm always tired. I just don't have the patience for that. That really makes me mad. Another Blue Monday. When will I ever learn? I get sick just thinking about it. Sometimes I just hate myself. What's the use? I'm just no good. I'm too shy. I never know what to say. I never had a chance. Things never work out right. I'm really out of shape. I never have any money. Why try? It's not going to work anyway. I've never been any good at that. My desk is always a mess. I never win anything. I'm over the hill. Someone always beats me to it. Nobody likes me. I never get a break. Sometimes I wish I'd never been born. I get so depressed. I'm just not a salesman. That's impossible. No way. I'm nothing without my first cup of coffee. I'll never get it right. I just can't take it anymore. I hate my job. I hate my wife. I hate my life. I get a cold this time of year every year. I'm really at the end of my rope. I never seem to get any place on time. I've always been bad with words. If only I were smarter, if only I were thinner, if only I were richer, if only she were taller, richer, smarter, if only, if only, if only. Yeah. And I learned that there is another station. And I can change stations. It takes a conscious thing. The station in my brain is set at default to KVOE. It's always going to be there. But I can change it. And it is KVFG, the Voice for God. And if I listen to that station, I hear a totally different thing. I hear a soft, reassuring voice that says to me, everything is going to be all right. I say, it says as I listen that you are whole, complete, and entire as you are right now, lacking nothing, needing no one. And when I hear that voice, I can see you with a certain degree of clarity. I no longer project on you all of my fear and rage. I no longer need to defend myself against the world. I have an answer to the question that Einstein said was the final unanswered question, and that is the universe friendly? And when I am listening to the right station, it is clear to me, yes, the universe is friendly, that I have the possibility of feeling at one with the people around me, and I have seen miracles occur. You know, Fred taught me that I was going to have to learn how to love, and I didn't start by loving my children or my wife. I started by trying to work the 12th step as best I could. I started by being nice to drunks and started to care about them. And one day I discovered that I had learned how to love. I 12-stepped a kid named Raymond when he was 19 years old, and Raymond was a pain in the ass. I have had some, I've gotten a little juiced on occasion for people I sponsor, you know. They say, oh, you sponsor Joe? And I say, yeah. You sponsor Sean and Jerome and that athlete and the movie star? And I say, yeah. I never got any credit for sponsoring Raymond. Raymond just couldn't stay sober. He didn't stay sober. The longest he ever got was 60 days. And he was a lot of trouble. I mean, one time he had smoked a little dope. He was staying at a 12-step house and he got paranoid and he decided to escape. You can go out the front door, you know what I mean? And so he snuck out the back door and jumped over a little 3-foot wall, and it had a 10-foot drop, and he broke his back. And so then we had to take him to meetings in a body cast. You know, there'd be three of us that get him in there and prop him up at an angle in the front row and say, get the message, Raymond, get the message, you know. And Raymond kept not getting the message. And this went on and on, 4 years of it. I talked him down off of acid trips. I got him out of jail. I put him in 12-step houses. I got him in hospitals and out of hospitals. And one day I had him down in a little flea bag motel on South Figaro, and I went down to pick him up, take him to a meeting, and he wasn't out in front. He never did what I asked him to do. And I parked the car, and I went upstairs, and I found him. I pushed the door open. He was lying there on the bed with pills still undissolved in his mouth and an empty liquor bottle in his hand, and Raymond was dead. Raymond was 23. And as I stood over him, alone in that little flea bag hotel, it dawned on me that I loved him. I loved him for nothing. I loved that guy. I didn't want anything from him. I didn't get any rewards for it. I loved him. I just wanted him to be given what I had been so freely given. I wanted him to have sobriety. And some of my rage returned. You know, why couldn't God give Raymond sobriety? You should see some of the people that I know that he gave sobriety to. Why couldn't he give it to Raymond? Where is your loving God? But by then I knew a little about working this thing, and so I talked to my sponsor, and I told him my feelings, and I prayed angrily, but I prayed. And I went to meetings, and I ended up going to a convention, and one of those odd synchronistic things occurred. One of the speakers happened to be a guy named Raymond, and he happened to have lost his brother 2 weeks before the talk he gave. And he had been given that kind of generosity of spirit that occasionally occurs in Alcoholics Anonymous, where he was willing to share his innermost feelings in public in the hopes that it would help somebody. And as he talked about his brother's death, he said, my brother died, but he doesn't have to drink anymore. And that one sentence freed me. It made it possible for me to let go of Raymond. It made it possible for me to make a decision to stop asking the question why. It's not an answer I'm going to get. I don't ask why anymore. I just try to take care of that 2 feet of space that I occupy. I just try to find peace within me. And I don't need to judge you or God. And it has become a great deal easier since then. And I've learned that I'm I'm getting pretty good at loving. I can love you whether you like it or not, you know. And my youngest daughter, my sponsor told me that that was going to be necessary, that I didn't need her permission to love her. And it has taken a long time. And just recently, and only very tentatively, she has begun to give me permission to love her. And but that's okay. I loved her anyway. So the changes that have occurred within me are extraordinary. The distance from which I have come is light years. And I didn't know that that was going to happen. All I knew is that I couldn't stand where I used to be. All I knew is that I didn't want to be a spy anymore, that I didn't want to wear disguises. And I began to hear the things that saved me. I was taught that I am as sick as I am secret, and so I don't have any secrets. And that makes it so simple for me to walk day to day. I don't have to remember what I told you last, you know. And so it's a long way and a delightful road. On Monday I was 60 years old, and that was never in the plan. I mean, they used to say if he shapes up, he might make 30, you know. And here I am 60, and all four of my children made a sincere effort to tell me they loved me. They bought me presents. You know, they're talking to me now. And I've got five grandchildren, and the oldest one is 17. So none of them have ever seen me drink. They think that an alcoholic is somebody that goes to meetings, you know. My children know what an alcoholic is, but my four-year-old Paloma says, "You going to a meeting, Pa Jack?" And I say, "Yeah." "What should I tell him?" And she says, "Tell him keep coming back. It works, you know." Her dad goes to Al-Anon, and so does her mother. And when she gets mad at her mother, she'll call me. One time she called me and she said, "Pa Jack, Debbie made me so mad I had to say the Serenity Prayer." And if I see the God in you, it reflects back to me. And Fred began to teach me how to live sober. And that has been going on all these years. I came to you feeling lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid every day of my life. Drunk or sober, I always felt like that. I just tried to keep you from finding it out. And if I work the steps, practice the principles, and live in the fellowship of the Spirit, I don't feel that way at all. Instead, I feel at one, at peace, and full of joy. And then I live in the infinite now. Thank you.